This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Today, we're going to be talking all about farmers and President Trump. As you may know, the rural community, including much of the farming community, supported Trump in the 2016 election, which was arguably not in their best interest. We're going to dive into the issue of why this was the case and the expected repercussions of the Trump administration will have on this community. Joining us on the line to talk through these issues is Alicia Harvey and Brian Barth. Alicia is the Advocacy and Issues Director at FarmAid. Founded by Willie Nelson, Neil Young, and John Mellencamp in 1985, FarmAid is a nonprofit organization that promotes a strong and resilient family farm system of agriculture. Also with us on the line is Brian Barth, a journalist focused on food, farming, and the environment, and a writer at large for the magazine Modern Farmer. Alicia and Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so before we dig into the most obvious question of this conversation, I want to start by kind of providing some context to the community we're going to be talking about. So in thinking about your work, how do you define rural communities, and what are the different sort of categories of agriculture producers in the states today? Alicia, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think we work with, because we're always pulling from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's data, we generally run with their definitions about rural America. So that usually includes areas that are non-metro, that include open countryside, that have rural towns with often fewer than 2,500 people, and that might include urban areas, but with populations that are usually under 50,000 and aren't connected to a labor market like, you know, a major city. And there's about 46 million Americans who fit into that, about 2 million of which are farmers.
And then what are the kind of different categories of farmers, broadly speaking, when we talk about this issue?
I mean, you know, farming is an incredibly diverse field, to be honest. You know, I think a lot of people think of sort of large commodity farms when they think of agriculture, which is certainly a hugely important part of American agriculture production, and it produces quite a large share of the total food production from the U.S. But there are many mid-sized and small farmers. There are an array of crops and animals that they grow, mm-hmm. and they also represent a whole range of races and also, you know, women and men male farmers. So at FarmAid, we deal with really the full range of farmers out there.
Now I want to start with the explanation of why the rural and farming communities overwhelmingly supported his candidacy. So Alicia, can you just kind of kick us off with a few of the you know, reasons that you believe this was the case, maybe starting with sort of the history of how we kind of got to this point.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, starting with the history is good, because the reality is that neither campaign actually spoke effectively about farm policy, nor has really any presidential campaign done that. And that's something we hope changes very much moving forward, because every American has a stake in what happens on our farms. But, you know, I think it's important to dig deep when we think about why did this election turn out the way it did. You know, putting aside the fact that there are a diversity of farmers out there who have many different political ideologies, you know, much of rural America struggled to recover from the 2008 recession. And I think you could make the argument that it never really recovered from the 80s farm crisis. That's certainly when Farm Aid came into existence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the common thread is really this progression of pro-corporate policies that really date back to the 1970s that were designed to move farmers off the land in the name of efficiency, economic efficiency. And so there's really been a dramatic, I mean, to the tune of maybe 2 million farmers or more that we lost by 1990. And that had a dramatic effect on the fabric of rural communities and the status of rural economies. And I think there's kind of a brewing anger out there in rural America and, you know, partially, if not heavily, explains why so many gravitated toward Trump, particularly when the farm economy is in a really tough place right now.
So they thought that Trump, kind of similarly how he spoke to those in the Rust Belt, they thought this particular community thought that Trump and his policies could affect change in terms of their economic well-being?
Well, I think it appears that the Trump campaign was more effective at speaking, you know, understanding kind of lightning rod issues that farmers would care about and speaking to it. I would reiterate that neither did that as successfully as some candidates of the past did, but when it feels like no one's listening to you, mm-hmm. you know, I could see, and I think many are starting to understand why the sense of someone who's going to buck the system when the system has been so atrocious for your concerns is, you know, there is an appeal there.
What about, Brian, can you start us on the conversation about TPP? Because this was kind of a hot button issue in the campaign, and we know that Trump and actually Bernie Sanders, for that matter, were very much against this policy. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what it entails?
Well, without going into great detail, the TPP was you know, a NAFTA-like policy, essentially, for the Pacific Rim countries. And as far as agriculture is concerned, it of course, applied to a broad array of industries far beyond agriculture. But, you know, the idea was to reduce trade barriers to American products, and the United States produces far more of certain agricultural products than it consumes, especially in the commodities area of grains and soybeans and nuts and things like that, and dairy and meat. So that export market is very important to a lot of farmers, and, you know, had a lot of agribusiness lobbyists behind it. And so those folks, you know, even though they may have voted for Trump because they tend to be a Republican-leaning bunch, that's an area where they did not see eye to eye.
How does that explain why they did vote for, you know, pulling out of TPP? Because it seems like that would have a negative effect on most farmers in this country.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. It is a contradiction. It's an area that, you know, perhaps if you're a beef farmer and you rely somewhat on exports to Asian markets.
Mm-hmm.
I know Japan was a big one, that the TPP was, you know, going to help a lot more American beef move to Japan. And if you voted for Trump, then you were overlooking that difference.
Alicia, yeah.
Well, I was going to offer that I think there was a real differential between how major agribusiness interests, the major trade organizations, spoke about the TPP, and they were vastly pro-TPP,
mm-hmm.
but that was actually starkly different than how a lot of farmers felt about the deal. So, you know, TPP was written by and for corporations, and, you know, farmers' sense of their trade advantage has really changed over the last several decades. And I think farmers were starting to feel that.
How has it changed?
Well, I would, you know, in the 1970s, let's say, farmers, American farmers, had probably a 65% share of the global grain trade, and that has plummeted to 30% over the last decade. The U.S. trade deficit for fruits and vegetables, let's see, in 2015, it was $11.4 billion. So we were vastly importing more than we were exporting for fruits and vegetables. The Korea Free Trade Agreement actually hit American beef producers very hard. And so there was this growing shift that someone's benefiting, but most likely it's major agribusinesses, and they were trying to speak on behalf of farmers, but a lot of farmers took great issue with it. And I think particularly when they saw the death of the country of origin labeling, COOL, which was, you know, for major meat products and vastly supported by farmers and consumers. And sort of the pro-agribusiness lobby was able to kick it to the curb under international trade regime rules. And so there was this growing sense that TPP, you know, there was a farm voice speaking against it in collaboration with labor and environmental and a lot of other interests.
And COOL required, COOL waived the requirement to label meat in terms of its country of origin. Is that right?
Yeah, so it would have labeled major meat products so that you could know where that meat comes from. And American farmers obviously would find great interest in helping consumers know that their meat comes from America. Mm-hmm. And agribusiness really had no interest in that transparency being there.
And another thing that kind of came up in the election discussion was immigration. This was a huge issue. So, Brian, can you talk us through what some of the proposed policies, both kind of prior to the election and then post-election, mean for farmers, and how it kind of like influenced maybe farmers' decisions to support Trump?
Sure. Well, just I guess to backpedal a little bit for context. It's estimated that between 50% and 70% of farm workers in the U.S. are undocumented immigrants, about 95% of those from Mexico. And there is an agricultural visa for temporary agricultural workers in the United States, but it actually supplies, you know, relatively few farm workers to the agricultural sector. It's considered, you know, kind of a broken system, both by farmers and the workers. So that being said, that cheap supply of agricultural labor is, an underpinning of our food system, and it keeps food prices relatively low in the U.S. compared to most other countries in the world. And farmers, of course, you know, individual circumstances vary, but there's oftentimes a real shortage of labor. And so this is, again, kind of like the TPP, where some farmers, even though they may have been pro-Trump on certain issues, kind of at least within their own circles would be murmuring, but he's not really going to deport our farm workers, is he? And, there were certainly signals from his agriculture advisory team during the campaign to assuage those fears. No, we're not going to mess with the farm labor system in a way that is going to hurt farmers' interests and need for a cheap labor supply, for better or for worse, and that's a whole other conversation. But that the reality of that remains to be seen, because when you're doing these deportations, as he has continued to pledge that he will do, how are you going to select, whether this person that you're looking to deport because they're undocumented as a farm worker or not. You know, that starts to get very complicated very quickly. And even just the rhetoric around tightening of the border and of deportations, I think, is arguably going to restrict the labor supply on farms. And so that's a great concern to a lot of farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the real issue there, I think, is that the farm labor system is broken on multiple fronts. But in terms of your question about farmers voting for Trump, I think, you know, they, in the back of their mind, said, you know,
he's not really going to do it.
All these folks, because, you know, he's a businessman. He realizes that we depend on that cheap labor, and that rhetoric is really serving a different purpose in his campaign.
So
how that plays out, we'll see.
So what, Alicia, what in your opinion, what could this look like if it does play out? Say he does kind of proceed with an order that affects the majority of farm workers in the United States. How does that play out, and what are the repercussions for consumers?
Well, I think Brian's right, and the effects would be dramatic. Setting aside the questions about maybe what farm labor should look like, there's the reality of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I would agree, there was a great New York Times piece covering farmers in California who were pro-Trump but really didn't think that his conversation about the border wall and deportation was really going to happen, and are very, very concerned. And already with the ICE raids kind of sweeping through the country, there are fields that are kind of out there with rotting produce. I think for fruit and vegetable sector, it's a major problem. Just the San Joaquin Valley in California is a $35 billion industry, and they're feeling that. You know, the dairy industry increasingly is dependent on farm labor, particularly, you know, bigger dairies. And there are, I think, Brian, you might have even cited some notes that, you know, there's concerns that retail milk prices could spike. Obviously, immigrants play a crucial role in our food system. There are farm workers, there are restaurant workers. There's a lot of places where their hands touch our food and bring it to our plates. And, this is the worst case scenario, this kind of enforcement only approach to immigration. Even the American Farm Bureau, which is very conservative, to them, what's going on now is like the worst case scenario for the food system.
And is the thought that, we couldn't possibly replace these farm workers with American citizens?
Well, this is hard work, and it's highly skilled work. Not everyone can successfully jump into a field and pick produce without ruining, and I think it's often considered this low-skill work, but it really isn't, and I don't think we should assume that any American will just fill in for them. It's long hours, it's low pay, and again, that's setting aside the bigger conversation about what should that system look like and what are the implications of it. And I would say, you know, there's large farms, but there's also mid-sized farmers that I've certainly talked to who use workers as part of the H-2A visa program that Brian mentioned. And in many cases, they've worked with these families for many years and even decades. And so there's also this personal loss that they're feeling in addition to what they're seeing in their bottom lines.
Wow.
I would add that, you know, there's been quite a few studies actually looking at Americans' willingness to do farm work and in areas with very high unemployment, you know, programs to actively recruit farm labor from the pool of unemployed workers, native-born American workers, has been just almost entirely unsuccessful. You know, like one study there was in North Carolina, there was, you know, like 200,000 unemployed workers who, you know, were contacted and essentially offered the opportunity to work on farms, you know, more or less at minimum wage. And, you know, a few hundred actually applied for the job. A handful showed up.
And, wow.
You know, like five of them actually completed the season.
So that's, I mean, that is just crazy, right? I mean, we have unemployment is an issue, although you can say that it's down. If you look at you know, some statistics, but we have a lot of Americans who just aren't willing to do the work, it seems like you're saying. It's and, you know, by the way, it kind of brings to light minimum wage is abysmally low. I mean, you can't possibly live on, what is it, $7.25 an hour, which kind of, you know, in thinking about that and in kind of and in playing maybe the devil's advocate a little bit, would it be a good thing ultimately to kind of focus more on U.S. production, even if it will drive the prices up? Like, shouldn't we be paying more for our food, and wouldn't those effects be felt in the labor market?
Yeah.
Alicia, do you want to go first?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say it goes hand in hand, right? Back in the 80s, you know, farmers realized when they were in the middle of a deep crisis and a deep pricing crisis that their need for fair pricing that would give them, you know, more than it cost them to produce food was directly tied to the struggle of labor to get fair wages. So our ability to be able to afford food that is represents a fair price to farmers, it does require thinking about standard of living across the board. And at present, the system seems to really mostly favor corporations who are really have a control over the marketplace and able to somehow both put downward pressure on the prices farmers receive and also try to keep prices low because consumers aren't making, you know, living wages. So it's an important connection to make.
And it seems like a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
Brian, do you have anything to add to that?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, most Americans could afford to pay more for their food. I think the bottom rungs certainly could not, and I think, you know, social safety net programs are important to address that, but the vast majority of Americans could pay a little more, and, you know, it wouldn't actually take that much of an increase in food prices to support a massive increase in farm worker wages, just the way that the economics sort of pan out. You know, it's like $40 more a year at the grocery store equals, you know, 40% higher wages. Don't quote me on those exact figures, but, you know, that's roughly what economists have worked out. And so, yeah, there's some other forces at play, you know, kind of taking advantage, you know, economically of that system and pulling the strings on it. But I think, you know, grassroots efforts to, you know, bring awareness to the issue and, you know, even things like labels, you know, sort of fair food type certifications are really important. You know, people will pay drastically more for organic produce, those that can afford to, and I think, you know, those same people would pay a bit more for food produced in fair labor circumstances here in the United States.
Okay. All right. So I just want to interject really quickly. We're going to have to take a really quick commercial break right now to hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, I want to continue the conversations about the reasons why and repercussions of farmers voting for Trump. So lots more to come. Stay tuned.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Okay, and we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're speaking with Alicia Harvey from FarmAid and Brian Barth, a writer at large for Modern Farmer. Picking up where we left off, it seems like the other kind of big component of potentially why farmers supported Trump were environmental regulations. And we certainly know from what we've heard so far from the administration that they're not a very big fan of regulations in general, and certainly not environmental regulations. So I'm wondering, Brian, can you kind of kick off this conversation? Are there any you know, proposed regulations or regulations in place right now that the administration kind of has in its crosshairs, or is it just more generally speaking?
Well, the one that, you know, farmers talk the most about by far is the WOTUS rule, which stands for Waters of the United States, which was a clarification that President Obama issued regarding how the Clean Water Act should be implemented, essentially. And it gave the EPA greater latitude than it had historically had to regulate surface water on private land. All surface water of the United States, are under the jurisdiction of the government, and through that, the Clean Water Act has sort of the right to impose restrictions on how land use affects water quality, including farmland. And so this WOTUS rule was, hailed by many environmentalists and sort of decried by a lot of rural landowners as giving the EPA excessive reach into limiting or defining how they could use their property. And so even anecdotally, I have heard from many environmentally-minded farmers that they felt the rule was excessive and would prefer to, have more of their own leeway to determine how they would use their land, even though they want to reach the same goals. So Trump has, the Trump camp has certainly signaled that WOTUS will be rolled back at some point. I don't think there's an absolute guarantee of that, but I think it is pretty likely.
Mm-hmm.
So we will see.
What do you mean by surface water? Is that runoff, or are those streams?
Well, that's what the WOTUS rule sought to define more explicitly. Certainly any lake, river, or stream has, already been defined as waters of the United States. And so this new rule basically extended that potentially in many instances to irrigation ditches, roadside ditches, low-lying, land that may at certain times of year collect water on a farmer's property. If there is a connection, a hydrologic connection between surface water, basically rain that falls and collects anywhere, even if it's just a ditch for a few hours after a rain, that water collects on private property, it can potentially trigger EPA jurisdiction to how the land around it is being used. So, for example, things like herbicides and pesticides and erosion control and all of those things, the EPA can start to tell you what you can and can't do.
I mean, wouldn't it ultimately be a good thing, though, for not only for farmers' health, but also the longevity and productivity of their land? Alicia, is this another example of how farmers might not, maybe didn't vote in their best interest?
Well, I think it depends on how you slice it. I mean, with the WOTUS rule, was controversial among farmers. The broader issue, though, is, there's certainly farmers out there who see EPA as a partner to keep our soil and our air and our waters clean and safe. There's great overlap between the Department of Agriculture and the EPA on issues around our natural resources. And, you know, historically, it's been an important boon for farmers to have policies that incentivize stewardship. So I think there's plenty of farmers out there who understand that connection, and whether they'd be for the type of EPA that might roll out under Trump is a question, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's, like I think Brian hinted, there are plenty of farmers who think long-term about the land that they're stewarding, and did WOTUS strike the right balance was, I think, you know, there was a frustration there that, that Trump did tap into.
What about, I mean, when we're kind of talking about this, is it fair to say that most smaller and mid-sized farms would be a little bit more accepting and willing to go along with some of these environmental regulations as opposed to the larger commodity farms? Or is that too much of an...
Yeah, I don't know if that's the easiest way to view it. The truth is, you know, in addition to EPA, there are a variety of programs out of the Natural Resource Conservation Service at USDA, which is a really important agency within it, that farmers of all types benefit from. And so there's different conversations about how do you make sure the lion's share of those programs don't only go towards one kind of farm. But I would say that it's interesting. Whereas EPA is more easily seen as the enemy for farmers, NRCS at USDA is often seen in friendlier terms. So sometimes it has to do with the messenger. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's honey, right? It's, you know, that there's an incentive there as opposed to additional burden. But, you know, we're always trying to find that space, that kind of bridges the historic divide between, you know, farmer and environmental concerns. And I think increasingly there's really impressive organizations and farmers who are straddling that and saying and showing how farm-based practices can actually be forward motion for our environmental concerns, can help mitigate climate change, can help clean our water. So we're hopeful that that continues.
Absolutely. And we actually interviewed one of the co-founders of a startup a few months ago. It's called Farmland LP, and they're basically their premise is to demonstrate that sustainable farming practices are actually more lucrative than more traditional methods of farming. So there is hope that it can take over. Okay, so I want to also kind of circle back to something that Alicia, you started to talk about in the beginning, which is this kind of this consolidation of farms towards hyper efficiency in the form of larger farms, and driven mostly by corporate takeovers. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this entails and who are these corporations that are kind of taking over the marketplace? And then also, what are the repercussions?
Mm-hmm. No, it's an important issue, and I actually think it's one where there's several segments of farmers who are looking to see if Trump is going to end up siding for farmers or for big agribusiness. You know, consolidation in agriculture has been happening over the last several decades to the point where if you look at almost any sector, you know, beef, pork, poultry, grains and seeds, the control that there's a threshold that economists use, you know, how much of a market share do the top four firms in that sector control? And across all of those, we're beyond the point where an economist would say it's a competitive market. And that has really important implications for farmers. As markets consolidate, farmers have fewer buyers for their products. They have less leverage over the marketplace. And this is happening not only on where they're going to sell their goods to, but also where they buy their inputs from. So there's you know, been skyrocketing seed prices that they're like well over, you know, 300% or 350%. Wow. When you look at the per acre costs. When we, and that kind of started with patented seeds in the mid-90s. So there's this really important relationship between corporate power over the food system and a farmer's ability to make a good price.
And patent seeds by a company such as Monsanto?
Yeah, sure. The Monsantos out there, the Bayers, the Dow DuPont, and all now what was called the Big Six in seeds. So Bayer, Monsanto, Syngenta, Dow, DuPont, and I'm forgetting one, of course. They're now all consolidating down to three. There are different places in that merger process. I think a lot of farmers were troubled by President Trump stepping in and trying to broker a deal between the Monsanto-Bayer merger, because that's one that is sparking a lot of concerns. And so, you know, we've already been seeing the Department of Justice greenlight merger after merger across food and agriculture. And there's not a lot of hope that, that Jeffrey Sessions as AG is actually going to stop that. He's been very favorable of those kinds of mergers in the past. So it's important.
And then the repercussions would be an inability of farmers to, would that just lead to lower, they can really increase the price of the inputs, like you said, and then farmers will make even less, which is crazy to think about because their margins, especially for commodity farmers, seem to be razor thin.
I mean, one of the sectors that we're keeping our eye on is poultry, because it's probably the most egregious example of not only corporate power across the sector, but also up and down. So increasingly, a company like a Tyson or a Perdue or a Pilgrim's Pride not only has an incredible market share, but it also owns many segments of the supply chain, and that has dramatically changed the relationship between the farmer themselves and their ability to have, control over what they make, but also the amount of risk they're made to take on. And there's a set of rules that are currently in limbo called the Farmer Fair Practice Rules, and they are part of that entire across-the-board 60-day delay on any regulations across the federal government right now. And I can tell you there are a lot of poultry growers who are firm pro-Trump supporters who are keeping their eyes on if that's going to go through, because they have been asking for those regulations and those protections for decades.
So to kind of summarize this conversation about the reasons why farmers supported Trump and then the repercussions of their support overall in these four categories, is it safe to say that farmers in general kind of voted against their best interest when looking at trade deals, environmental regulations, and immigration? Brian, do you want to take that?
Well, I would argue no, that they didn't vote in their best interest.
Yeah.
I think in this consolidation subject that you're just speaking of, I think that is the one arena where farmers are very, very united across the many shades of agriculture, from the biggest commodity farmers down to, small organic farmers. I think, but it is important, of course, to realize that, Trump himself will not, make agriculture policy in the coming years. And I think a lot of those folks that in agriculture that may have voted for him based on other issues besides farming. And so I think there are some really big things on the table, and I think, Trump may have lit a fire under certain things. Like I think farm labor reform and the H-2A visa system, I think, is going to have to be addressed in a very serious way in the coming year or two, and that's something that has just sort of floundered for basically decades. Mm-hmm. People have been working on that, and I think that, because of Trump's point of view, it is going to sort of force the hand, of all the different stakeholders to just get together and finally, you know, make some compromises and agree on some things.
And talking about kind of what's to come from an agricultural perspective, let's talk about Sonny Perdue, who is, of course, Trump's pick to head the USDA. Brian, I know that you've written about this quite a bit. So can you tell us about his background and what we can kind of expect to see from his stewardship of the agency?
Sure. I grew up in Georgia, where Sonny Perdue was governor in the early 2000s, really throughout the 2003 to 2011, maybe. You know, the biggest thing that he was known for, just in terms of nationally related to agriculture, is when Georgia was in an extreme drought, I think that was like 2007 and 8, you know, he organized this prayer for rain on the state capitol.
You know, all the main, that sounds a lot like a rain dance to me.
Yeah, and, you know, it actually started with a farm group. The Georgia branch of the Farm Bureau organized an event, and then Sonny Perdue, like, scaled it up and said, we're going to make this a statewide thing.
Wow.
But anyways, he grew up on a farm in a farming community, and he has owned a number of agribusinesses, you know, not like the Monsantos of the world by any means, but really regional businesses in the Deep South. And, you know, he's very conventional by the books. He, you know, I don't expect a big break from the status quo, but I don't necessarily think he's going to purposely go in and gut, you know, some of the strides in the USDA around supporting local and regional food systems. I think that is, has a lot of legs to stand on, and will survive, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Environmentally, you know, he's certainly going to side, I think, you know, with Trump on the rolling back the regulations.
Okay. I'm like, I'm, of course, a big fan of regulations, though, so in general. So that's not music to my ears. But hopeful in the support of farmers, like you mentioned. Alicia, what are some of the top food and ag policies that farmers kind of need support on now from the administration?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you, you know, Farm Aid runs a hotline, 1-800-FARM-AID. And so we're on the phone with farmers every day. And for us, even though we're not in the middle of the country, it's palpable to us, the kind of developing farm crisis going on in the countryside. Prices are low. Farmers have seen no relief in their input costs. Farmland values are expected to drop, I think, between 6 and 10% this year yet again. Net farm income is, I don't know, it's half or somewhere between 30 and 50% less than it was from its peak in 2013, and it's being felt. So, you know, programs that are really there to serve farmers in times of financial duress, their ability to access credit, and the ability of farmers of all backgrounds to access credit, right? There's a history that this last administration really tried to rectify to make sure that it was repairing some of the harm done to Black farmers and Latino farmers and Native American farmers who did not receive fair treatment at loan offices. That's an important one, I think, for Sonny Perdue and others to uphold. We're also going to be in the middle of a major farm bill development, the first one, you know, for the last 5 years. You know, every 5 years it comes up for reauthorization. And So there is a whole suite of programs in food and agriculture that, you know, this administration is going to have a role in carving out in concert with Congress, obviously. You know, I think that for farmers who are engaged in addressing climate change and its mitigation, flat-out denial of climate change's existence, or even the kind of tepid, my mind is open on it, that I think President Trump has expressed more recently, I'm concerned that that falls really short of what farmers need, you know, also related to our hotline, where we get calls from natural disasters across the country.
Yeah.
And we sense this exacerbation of droughts and floods and other major weather events. There's a real cost to that. There's a real emotional devastation to it. There are a suite of programs through USDA that help farmers in those times of need, but it can be the difference between survival or not if they can access those. And are they really ready for what we're probably going to face and are already starting to face with regards to climate change? I don't think, there's a lot of farmers out there who know that keeping our heads in the sand is not going to make it go away. And then I would say, you know, we really need work on the antitrust aspect of food and agriculture. And we need to, you know, wherever we are, rally around new kind of market alternatives that are popping up that have provided a great alternative. You know, the development of local and regional food systems, like Ryan kind of mentioned, that saw a huge renaissance over the last decade. That has to continue. You know, last year our show was in Appalachia. For a region that is hurt from the loss of tobacco and coal, you know, jobs related to food and agriculture and the rebirth of local food systems is a major bright point. And I think we should really consider that when we think about how to revitalize rural America.
And that speaks to my next question, which is what can consumers specifically do apart from supporting from a policy and voting with your, actually getting politically active. What can consumers do from a purchasing power standpoint to move the needle on some of these issues? Alicia, do you want to? I'm gonna give you that one also.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole, you know, bunch of new market structures out there that, you know, it's evident that people are participating in the growth in farmers markets. In programs like CSAs, where there's really no distance between the farmer and the consumer, right? The supply chain is cut very short, and it's been a boon for the health of Americans and for the bottom line for farmers. And it's kind of revitalized the celebration of what agriculture really brings to all of us. And so I would always encourage folks to keep on finding those spaces and deepening their connection to farmers, seeking out brands that are farmer-owned cooperatives and truly farmer-owned cooperatives, and doing a little bit of digging around that, I think is smart. We're big fans of farm-to-school programs, and we have a page up called Farm-to-School Rocks to honor our kind of music connection. But really, there are so many ways, no matter who you are, a student, a parent, a teacher, a school administrator, there pretty much any role you can imagine in the community, there's a way for you to champion something like a farm-to-school program. And there's a lot of other local policies like that that you can actually get your hands around in a way that is tangible and it doesn't feel far off and federal. And it's both, you know, through kind of political councils, but it's also just through the engagement you have with your schools and your colleges. So there's a lot of ways to get involved. It's never been easier to get involved, I'll say that.
Well, that is great news and truly optimistic, especially in a time where voting with your dollars really matters. And we are kind of seeing a renaissance of political activism on one side. So we're gonna have to end our conversation for today. But Alicia and Brian, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, for more coverage on this topic, be sure to check out Brian's articles on modernfarmer.com, as well as his website, brianjbarth.com. And go to farmaid.org to learn more about the nonprofit's upcoming events and how you can get involved. I also want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support. Our show is produced with help from Taylor Lanzette, and show music is by Tim Archer. Thank you to our engineer, Vidar Hirsch. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. Like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook and find us on Twitter at EatMattersHRN. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.